Girish Merchandani, Senior Principal from Howard Fisher Associates, a leading executive and board search firm, working with some of the top companies and senior executives throughout the nation. The HFA Leadership Forum features interviews with some of these exceptional leaders, providing insights into career paths, recommended best practices, and industry trends that are worth paying attention to. Today, I'll be talking to John Sobel, co-founder and CEO of Sight Machine, an industrial IoT company based in San Francisco and Ann Arbor, Michigan. John started his career, so John, here's your bio, correct me if this is right, in the legal field, and rose to become general counsel of Yahoo when the company was the internet company from 98 to 2003. He then went on to become CBS as SVP of strategy and BD, and then became GM of SourceForge, an open source software company, where you met your co-founder, Nate. Is that correct?
That's right, Girish. Yeah. Absolutely.
And then you worked at Tesla and Calera, general counsel, head of legal, and then started Sight Machine in 2012 with Nate Ossendorf. Today, they have a team of over 100 and have landed some of the top tier customers and brands and partners that include Nike, Microsoft, GE, Nissan, and some other really well-known brands. John is also an adjunct professor at the University of Michigan, where you went to law school and received your MBA from Wharton. And I think if I did my research correct, your undergrad was from Princeton.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. That's the most thorough complimentary bio. Thank you, Girish. You nailed it, sir.
All right. I've been working on it, Brad. Thank you. I've got high standards. I'm working with you.
Wow. I mean, I'd like to meet this guy you just told me about. Thank you.
And I feel very lucky, John. I've had the opportunity to partner with you and help you recruit some key leaders over the last 10 plus years. And I think I felt like I got to know you. And I would describe you, if someone asked me, as very humble, grounded in Midwest values with the East Coast edge when needed. I think it's the New York City. Aren't your I think your dad is from New York originally.
Wow. I feel totally seen by you. I never heard it put that way. And we know each other very well. I think you're right. We've been working together 10 years. I've known you almost 20, and you know your client very well here, sir.
Well, I feel very lucky to work with you. And then also you have a West Coast Silicon Valley mentality, which to me means constant innovation, kind of an open mind to just create. So hopefully that describes you. But John, let's get into it. And I'm very grateful to have this time to basically ask you questions and provide insight, as we mentioned. But let's start. What led you to become an entrepreneur, John, and start a company from scratch? And what process did you take to start Sight Machine?
Oh, Girish, thank you for the opportunity to join you and your audience. And you create a great climate for speaking candidly. So at the risk of offending people during our time together, I'm going to do my best to be honest and blunt. So for me, I now realize that inside of a lawyer's body, there was an entrepreneur that had been wanting to come out for a long, long time. Like a lot of people, the lore of entrepreneurship is that it's a young person's game. And of course, often it is. If you look at, you know, where really groundbreaking ideas come from in science and the arts, a lot of times it's people in their 20s. I went to business school in my early 40s. What happened to me was I had been fortunate to get on some management teams at public companies and that type of thing. Mm-hmm. And I felt like I really needed to fill out my understanding. So I went to business school to learn finance. And as often happens, when you open yourself up to an experience with one thing in mind, another thing happens. And they had these great classes and all these tests, and it all kept coming back, you're an entrepreneur. And my friends, there were these people in school who had done crazy things, and I just gravitated to entrepreneurs. And then I realized, as I look back, I'd always kind of gone for the entrepreneurial dimension of something, but never really had the confidence to just try something with people I believe in and a clean sheet of paper. Yeah. And I had this feeling like, oh man, you know, could I do this? Maybe one day it'll happen, you know? And then, as you mentioned, my colleague, Nate, the guy who had the idea for our company and really started the whole show, was somebody I had quote managed at an open source company. But anyone who's been in an open source company knows you don't really manage people. You try to get on the same wavelength. If you're a business person and they're technologists, they really are the ones creating the value. So Nate invited me to join him, and I thought, you know, I went and read a David Brooks column, believe it or not. I was deciding next steps in the career. And I read a column that David Brooks had put together where he got letters from people in their 70s and 80s. And he asked them, what do you regret about your life? What are you proud of? And it just happened to be he wrote this column while I was trying to decide what to do. And interestingly, he wrote about how everybody who had taken risk didn't regret taking risk. Everybody who had wished they had done things and hadn't done it really regretted that. And a lot of times the risk didn't work out. It wasn't like it was all good news.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, man, when I look back on it all, I do not want to have failed to check this out. So that's what got me into it. I'd love to tell you that I had deep knowledge and love of manufacturing at the time. Didn't know a thing about it.
Right.
We had founders at our company. We had a group of five founders. The other four were all incredible experts. So I learned. And so that's how it happened, was this feeling of, we don't have this much time on the earth. I want to stretch my wings and try something new. This is the group of people to do it with.
So brushing up on your finance skills allowed you to learn about yourself then.
Correct.
You realize you're an entrepreneur, and then you realize you wanted to take some risk and go for it.
You got to listen to the signal.
Yeah. And why do that when you had a very successful career? Isn't there this other voice that says, hey, John, stay in a corporate route? And I mean, being general counsel of Yahoo and CBS, and did that voice, where did that voice go?
Yeah. No, it didn't go away. And I really appreciate the thoughtfulness of the question. Rare is the person, I think, who loves one thing and then finds another and just throws it all out the window. I was about to go join a very, very successful, values-driven global law firm. I loved the people I met there. I interviewed with 60 people to join that firm. And we were talking about some incredibly creative, global, innovative things. And I think I would have loved that path. And I went home to my wife and said, okay, here's the fork in the road. Global law firm, just amazing portfolio of responsibility and opportunity. Really work with them to take the company into the next century. And I love the leadership there. I know I would have learned so much from them. Or, you know, Nate has this idea and he and I want to try something and we have no money and, you know, it's going to be a couple of years till we get financing. What do you think?
Yeah.
And she said, you got to do the second one. You wanted to do that. You got to do it. So one of the things I love about our company is we get to work with these great organizations. You mentioned some of them. These are very complex, large companies who are leading their industries. And we get the opportunity to talk to them about their strategy. And one of the things I love about the kind of innovation we're participating in is the really big game led by large companies is meeting the entrepreneur technology innovation community. And we're all trying to figure out how to move things forward together. So you still need that muscle. You still need to understand what a 100,000 person company looks like and how it works and what matters to people leading those organizations. And you got to clean up pretty well and, you know, put together complete sentences and have developed thinking and you know, do real work. It's cool.
That's awesome, John. What would you say? I was going to ask you this question later, but since you're on it, what was the vision of Sight Machine when you started and has that changed? And what's your vision today?
So, you know, the vision hasn't really changed. You mentioned we're both from the Midwest. And so when I say this, I'm sure it'll resonate. The culture of Silicon Valley is to point the bat at left field and talk about the big thing you're going to do well before you've built it.
Right.
And a more Midwestern culture is to be very deeply motivated. You know, I'm horribly generalizing here, so I don't want to offend any of our listeners. These are gross generalizations, but
this is all good.
Midwesterners were very motivated by Detroit at the time. It was 2011. Most of us had strong connection to Michigan, and it was clear that though this was the height of social media at that time, there were so many needs for technology to help with real world things, and we hadn't really figured out how to do it. Uh-huh. And I remember watching this amazing commercial in 2012, February 2012. It was a Super Bowl commercial that Clint Eastwood was in about it's halftime in America and trying to rebuild after the financial crisis. Uh-huh. Our vision was to contribute to a renaissance of industry, an industry that is sustainable, that provides economic vitality. I went on a huge research binge when I joined our company. I didn't know that manufacturing was 16% of GDP and just a huge driver of kind of research vitality. And you know, 4 years later in 2016, it became kind of a huge topic in politics. And there's this whole geopolitical thing going on. Germany is a great leader in manufacturing. Japan is, of course, a great leader in thinking about manufacturing. China, of course, is a force. The United States trying to figure out its future with manufacturing. So we were motivated by taking Silicon Valley technology and putting it to work in the service of rapidly evolving manufacturing, because it was clear that the way things have been working there has got to change on all kinds of levels. Now, what exactly would the business model be? What was the product? We started like everybody does with a pretty focused application. And then we realized there's just an incredible amount of pain and hassle in this industry around data. And there's all these web heads like us who should know how to work with data. If we could solve that problem, what could we unlock? And so that was kind of the vision at the beginning, but we didn't talk about it that way. We just talked about, you know, here's our product, here's our technology. And in the last year or two, we've developed enough momentum and proof and really strong partnerships with people who are thinking big. Mm-hmm. I think we've finally given ourselves permission to talk about the heart and all of this, what's motivated us from the beginning.
So it's really, I didn't realize this. I've always heard your vision from the beginning, but I didn't realize it's much bigger than Sight Machine. It was a vision about helping to rebuild the United States and helping to rebuild manufacturing.
Absolutely. You know, the people who founded the company, my technology colleagues, were rock stars on the internet. They were college kids, several of them at the time. They founded a site called Slashdot, which was in the first generation of the internet, a really strong technology community. It was kind of mm-hmm. a precursor to Reddit. And these people had all done amazing things and could just spend the next 20 years doing what they knew how to do. And we all felt restless and a little frustrated with where technology was going. But none of us, you know, you doubt yourself. You think, am I the problem? The whole world is going left and I want to go right. But we just had this feeling of maybe we could take these skills that everybody has and put them to work in this other domain. And then there was incredible validation that started to develop. GE, at exactly the time I was deciding to join Sight Machine, GE announced what they called the industrial internet. And that was the beginning of a multi-billion dollar, multi-year initiative on this. They had some, you know, well understood challenges. They were a pioneer, but when you see the GEs and the IBMs and the Siemens of the world all kind of turning the destroyer, the aircraft carrier towards this, it was a sign that this would be real one day. It sure does take a long time. It's incredibly hard, but you know, it's fun. Anything worthwhile is not easy.
Yep. And do you think, John, manufacturers or your, I guess your customers or prospects today are really open and being truly digital? Have they embraced that idea?
I would say they're all talking about it. Most of them want to be open. Maybe 10% are really, really ready. I want to be honest with your question. Whether you call it Industry 4.0 or digital transformation, or you talk about AI, it's all kind of really the same thing. All of these industries are doing a huge amount of research and investigation and exploration of this. A meaningful minority of companies are actually really ready. And the reason I say it that way is, it's always kind of framed as a technology problem. Like, oh, okay, can we find the right tech? Yeah. The right tech is there now. It's actually a change in culture challenge. Mm-hmm. And what, you know, whatever it is, if we look back through the last 1,500 years of technology adoption, there's always companies that kind of figure out how to take that stuff in. And that's really a function of culture. We see the number of companies that are serious about this and ready growing quickly. It's still a minority. It's really, really hard. It's really, really hard to successfully change how you work. And that's what they're all trying to do.
So it's really, I guess, change management then, and not changing technology, but I guess fear to try something new. Or
I'll give you a very concrete, you're absolutely right. I'll give you a really concrete example. And, you know, even words like change management, which is exactly the right kind of umbrella term for this, they don't do justice to the pain and the difficulty. So here's a great example. One of the things digital technology does is it provides transparency. You can know in a matter of seconds, how's Gearish's plant performing really? I'm depending on Gearish to send me some supplies, you know, to make medical supplies. Is he on time or not? And is his quality good? Everybody says they want transparency. It's one of these exalted virtues in American business.
Yeah.
If you're a plant manager and you're in a company where you get punished for having problems, I'll tell you a quick story. In 2013, 2014, we went to a plant in Utah and we showed them this great technology. And the plant manager looks at me, he says, I don't like this at all. And I said, why not? Yeah. And he goes, well, the first thing you know, there's going to be reports. And then corporate managers are going to tell me how to run my plant. I don't want you at all. Thank you very much. And he was being honest. In many organizations, the reward for transparency is to get punished. Mm-hmm. So why would you be transparent? So, you know, they'll say, oh, I want to do this. You have to be a company that is really prepared to bring into the open your challenges and reward people for fixing them. That, of course, is true whether we're talking about digital technology or not. It's just being a good organization. Yeah.
Do you think then people at the top are aware that the problem even exists?
The
C-suite?
The data problem?
Yeah, the data problem, or how they're not optimized, they're not efficient, there's no insight.
Yes, although if you get into really tactical discussions, interesting. We work on what we know, we work on what we can see. So companies are very good at pulling financial levers. They think about things like cost of capital really well. Yeah. They model that to death. They think about supply chain very well because we have tools and visibility into that. And then in factories, it's kind of a black box. We're like, oh, okay, they must know what they're doing. They're doing a hell of a job. They make stuff every month. That's pretty good. When you actually get into it, there's a ton of leverage and opportunity to improve operations. What I would say is that senior management that has been through real change before, they immediately go to, okay, how are we going to deal with the people part of this? Companies that have not yet gone through a cycle go, oh, okay, let's do some RFPs. We'll get some tech. We'll run some pilots. We'll pick it, and we're all good. And that's really just when the fun begins. That's really not the real game.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. What's a story that maybe you'd like to share, a standout, where it's reaffirming that you walked out of a plant or you left a customer's office and like, what I'm doing matters. And this is why I left that. I didn't take that job at that law firm. And
that's a great question. I'll tell you about a paper company we work with. This company is so brave. They are in an industry where the margins are really tight. Mm-hmm. And we went to a plant last summer, and there were two things that struck me when we visited. Walked in, the plant manager shook my hand. He said, I'm really glad you guys are here. We're trying to innovate. John, do you know that we've been in this town for 100 years? All the schools here were paid for by our tax dollars.
Wow.
And we really want to be ready for the next 100 years. That's how the conversation starts. And, you know, that stuff's real. There is an incredible ethos in manufacturing. The language that is used is about continuous improvement. That's a process term. Yeah. That's a tactical term. There's an ethos in manufacturing of, we got to constantly get better. We got to keep learning, but it's got to work. It's got to be right. And there's a lot of soul and purpose in manufacturing. The things that are made, you know, cars, drugs, doesn't matter what it is, are needed by people. So there is this kind of notion that's never spoken about of service to something doing something good in life. Uh-huh. So we're there. And then, you know, we walk the plant, which is enormous. And I'm with an engineer, and he says, John, we really, you know, there's all these problems we can't solve. I know we could solve them. Let me show you all of our kind of cloud technology right now. And he opens up a closet. And there's a couple. Right. He goes, this is what we have. But we're on our way to a much bigger game. And then we started talking about all the things that they could fix, the energy they could save, the productivity, the pride that you see in people's eyes. They go to these jobs for 20 or 30 years. They're always trying to get better. And the excitement that they have about improving things is palpable. So what I really connect with is the people doing the work every day. It feels really good. We get a lot of phone calls. We do a lot of lately we've been doing a lot of remote sessions with people where they're diagnosing problem solved. And when they fix something, the excitement that they have about, you know, making it 3% better over last week is just awesome. And the other insight we've had is there are some big bang wins. You know, there have been times we did a hackathon, believe it or not. All the operators at a paint plant in India did a hackathon over a weekend. Our technology went live. They got all their operators together. Everybody came in for 2 days. They improved the productivity of their operation 7% in 2 months by doing a hackathon.
That is incredible. Yeah.
The excitement that they felt was amazing. So that's kind of my rocket fuel.
Yeah.
And the nature of this work is you get a big bang like that sometimes, but it's really the accretion of hundreds of improvements over a year or two. And you just keep getting better and better. So, yeah. So we've seen some great stuff like that. And I just really admire the people who are bringing change to their companies. It's really hard. We always talk about how we got to protect the change leader. We got to take away risk for them and make it safe and successful. And we never let them down because, you know, those people are basically putting their careers on the line to bring something new.
Mm-hmm. That's great, John. Thank you for sharing. Appreciate that.
Yeah.
Let's switch gears a little bit. What would you say has been the biggest learning experience you've had as a CEO of a technology company, technology startup?
Yeah. That is a great question. I would say for me, the learning has been, and this applies for myself and other leaders in our company, the last couple of years as we've been scaling, I've been thinking a lot about leadership. And none of these ideas are mine. So this is truly a learning to really lead. So we've had some leaders that have been incredibly talented individuals who have led well. We've had some who have struggled with leadership. I've had my challenges. And what I've taken away from working with my colleagues and advisors and working on myself, it has nothing to do with technology. If you're going to lead, you have to be willing to look inside and do the tough work in yourself so that you are actually capable and qualified and worthy of leading other people because you've understood your own motivations and feelings and managed them well. And you know, a writer, a venture capitalist named, I don't even know if I'm pronouncing his name right, I've never met him, Jerry Colonna, wrote a book that I read last fall about his theme was basically, if you're gonna lead a technology company, the work starts inside. And this, I just think it's so true. If you look at the state of leadership in America today, we all know what real leadership feels like. We wanna get behind leaders, we all need it. And so I have spent a lot of time in the last couple of years working with our leadership team and myself on how do we really become good leaders. And we have this phrase that one of our leaders coined. He told people on his team, if you come to our company, you will experience extreme personal growth. And it's a little lighthearted, but, yeah. But it's a valid point. If you're going to grow as a leader and if you're going to do something hard, most of your challenge is not figuring out the Excel or the strategy or the tech. It's figuring yourself out. so that you can keep that all straight and be a real leader. And none of us could, you know, come into the world knowing how to do that. So that's what I've been focusing on. It's been a really important insight.
That's awesome. Thanks for being so open, John. And then on a switching gears again, what would you say is the biggest challenge you've had to overcome then, as a company or as a leader?
I'll give you an answer to both. Going backwards. For me, I grew up, I wasn't particularly good, but I played on some sports teams. And I was fortunate early in my career to work at organizations that were incredibly team oriented. Team's one of those words that is totally overused. Real teams are rare. Real teams are rare. All the research about companies talks about how what we really have is working groups, kind of executives each have their own zone. And it's almost a treaty, like I'll stay out of yours and you stay out of mine and I'll do marketing and you do sales or whatever. Real teamwork is rare. And I grew up in a tradition of incredible teamwork. So I had that figured out. What I had to develop as a CEO was managing day-to-day accountability. I was always comfortable with the, hey, this isn't working out, we got to have the tough talk. But on the way to that moment, there's 100 little moments where you just check with people every day. Is this getting done? And there's really two types of accountability. One's results, the other's behavioral. You see somebody not handling themselves well, it's really hard to feel comfortable saying, hey, I saw how you were working in that meeting. Do you think it would have been better if you had, instead of saying what you said, said it another way? It took me a long time to develop the confidence and the clarity to get really good at managing both types of accountability on all the small steps on the way to the big check-ins. So that was my work on. I'm still working on it, but it's been very clarifying. I'll tell you, the toughest thing for a company like us was staying alive. The first 5 or 6 years, it took a long time to develop our technology, and we knew we had a good vision. It was a question of timing. And a couple of years ago, I said to somebody, gosh, you know, it feels like the timing's just right. And they said, hey, your company should take credit. You stayed alive long enough for the timing to be right. And what I realized is, if you're going to do something like this, you kind of got to be early to be on time, but you got to make it through, you know, Death Valley. And it's just hard to raise capital. We had some very foresightful investors. It's hard to engage companies at a scale that, you know, needs to happen. So I give Sight Machine and everybody here a lot of credit for scrappiness and grit and getting through it all. We're at the fun part now.
Mm-hmm. That's great. So it sounds like you've learned a lot.
Yes. And the learning continues.
It does. It never stops. Right. Let's talk about today's world. I think we need to touch upon it. And this 2020, which has been bizarre, whatever you want to call it, an interesting year. Totally. How have you been able to manage this crisis as a company? And what are some of the positive takeaways you've had internally as a team?
That's a great question, Girish. So on certain very tactical aspects, we were fortunate. We're a real technology company. Our secret sauce is the result of 7-8 years of work by a team of 30, 40 engineers. And most of those folks are already working remotely for a good part of the week. We were quite easily able to just click in to the remote mode. But what was really interesting was purpose. And I think we're just fortunate in this respect. About a year ago, we had a new leader join our company, and he's very experienced. His name is John Merrills. He's been working in Silicon Valley for 30 years. And he said, there is some great culture in this company and you haven't made it explicit. We need to really write down our values. And I'll just tell you, I've always been moderately skeptical of the good old mission statement. When you see one that sings, it really gets to you the vast majority of them don't sing. And he said, you guys have a really cool culture, but you don't talk about it and you don't make it explicit. We need to do that. So we did. And it was surprisingly easy because the values were there, but they hadn't been codified. I mentioned this because we realized that while people are physically separated and the pressure is on, the deeper you go into purpose, the more people find it easier, A, to figure out what to do, and the more powerful it is. And it's very, you know, it's like everything around values. You can't have the values because they're going to make you successful as a business. Then it doesn't work. You actually just have to have the values. You have to care about them. And then you get to be successful as a business. If you're transactional, like, hey, we should come up with some good values to motivate people, is not the same as actually having them.
All right.
And so we really thought about what are people responding to? Who are we? And then it was very interesting to get very concrete when the civil unrest a couple of weeks ago after George Floyd's murder and the civil unrest began, several people in the company wanted to do something but didn't know what to do, didn't know what you know, 100-person technology company could do. And we had a very reflective conversation. We talked about some of the corporate statements that are out there and how they are well-written and they clearly espouse heartfelt values. We have a very smart, skeptical group of people, many millennials in our company who are suspicious of that type of thing. And we discussed what's the right thing to do. And we felt that the right thing to do was admit we weren't sure what to do, to create a community space in our company for a real discussion about how people could respond and also make sure that it wasn't top-down led. One of the things that I really admire about our company is we have a lot of strong leadership that doesn't necessarily come from the management team. So a group of four people in the company hosted a first discussion on ideas about how we might contribute to solving the problems. What is appropriate and effective? What can be done by a company? What should we do? It was an optional meeting, and there was a lot of emotion and power in the conversation, and it was led not by the managers, but by these people who were very committed. And because of our values and the ground rules we were able to establish, it was an incredible conversation. Some of the ideas included things, believe it or not, like we need to learn to listen. Instead of just taking action as a company, maybe we should educate ourselves about blind spots that we have. How do we do that effectively for our people? How can we contribute to solving problems? How, with diversity, of course, is there anything we can contribute our technology towards? And we came up with a punch list of 10, 15 things. People volunteered. And what I loved about it is it was organic. It wasn't top-down led.
Yeah.
And it was the kind of response I think people are looking for right now. Hopefully authentic, honest, clear, hard-hitting, no wishy-washy stuff, but people really trying to come together and work together on some problems. So it's been really interesting through the last couple of months to watch our company step into its into its voice.
That's really interesting. So this time then brought you closer, and it brought you closer because it sounds like the conversations you had were more real.
Absolutely.
And it goes back to your comment about values, not just being values because they look cool, but values that really kind of hit you at the gut. It matters.
And I'll tell you, you know, as CEO, you're supposed to write these company-wide emails regularly. And I always try to, I remember reading emails like that and thinking, that's just BS, you know, like at various companies, you know, I worked for many fine leaders with many good emails, but I've read a lot of corporate emails that I thought were hollow. And the hardest email I've ever had to write was the email about George Floyd, because I thought to myself, everybody is watching each other and is going to read this and consider, are my colleagues, are my leaders serious? Are they real? what is this? And I was really moved by the leadership our colleagues show and the quality of the conversation that's happening in our company and the clarity. I mean, we talked about, look, we're a business. Mm-hmm. Our job is to create value and to succeed and thrive in creating value for other people. There are really important issues here for society. We don't want to ignore or avoid them. We want to think intentionally about what we as a community of people can do as a community. And that needs to be a community discussion that is held in the space of our company. And it needs to be led by people in the community, and decisions need to be made and decided upon as a community. How do we do that? It was really cool. And we said, we don't have it figured out. We don't know where this is going. We're going to create a forum and we're going to support it with the resources of the company. And we're going to do our best to keep it real. And then it's up to everybody to take it wherever it goes. Mm-hmm. So we don't know yet, but I'm incredibly moved by the seriousness and authenticity of the people who are leading the work.
That goes back. I think it sounds like you've done a great job. You and your team has hired a great job attracting people that are change, that are innovators, that have open thinking, that are part of this open culture that you've kind of talked about. So
thank you. We're trying. Yeah. And that's another insight that, you know, it's very relevant to the work you and I do together. We've had really strong retention over the years, and we've been able to recruit and attract very talented people in an area of the world that's had vicious talent wars. Uh-huh. And we could not compete by offering the highest salary. We don't have a gym and private chefs, and it's risky. And so we tell people when we're recruiting them, this may not work. Here's the problem we're working on. Here's the people you'll be around. We find that people who thrive here are very motivated by working on something hard and really care about the quality and skills of the people they work with. And if you get that right, water seeks its own level. You just keep attracting great people, and then they attract other great people. And it's such a truism. But, you know, I remember a couple of years ago, we have some investors who aren't from Silicon Valley, and they're like, how are you going to compete, man? You know, look at the salaries. Like, what are you going to do? You know, and we just realized we're very fortunate. If you get enough good people and they sign up for the mission, they will attract other good people. And, wow. And you just gotta stick to the basics. It works out.
Well, that's awesome. And it goes back to your first comment. It comes down to purpose, right? When you realize your purpose was to be an entrepreneur, and then it sounds like your purpose then was to become, to change and have all your other leaders look within and change and become better leaders. And it goes back to purpose. It sounds like that's one common theme that's come out of this, which
does. And I'll tell great. You, you're really such a skilled kind of leader of the conversation here. I don't think we've ever talked about this publicly. I know I have. And I always feel mildly uncomfortable, a little guilty in a way talking about this stuff. Because, you know, it's shareholder value. We're here to make money. We want to have a great company. I hope that it's here for many years, long after those of us who started it are gone. But in the end, it is about purpose. That's why we all do what we do in life. Cool. Yeah.
That's great, John. I want to be respectful too. I don't want you talking to purpose. I don't want your board members coming up and saying, why are you doing a podcast? Why aren't you closing a large manufacturing deal?
But well, that's also a problem, man.
Let's switch gears and end on something completely different. And let's say college football is back, John. Is Michigan going to win a national championship this year?
So, we're in the data science business here.
Yeah.
The data does not suggest we're going to win next year. I'm eternally hopeful. Michigan's had ups and downs. It tests your loyalty. We'll see how it goes.
No, so Jim Harbaugh's used your software then for Insight or not yet?
We have not yet been offered the opportunity to assist. If we ever get it, we'll take it in a minute.
I tell you, the short answer is no. Well, this has been awesome, John. I feel like our listeners and whoever gets a chance to listen to this is going to learn a lot, reflect a lot. And I think you've shared. Thank you for being so open, transparent, and This has been really awesome. I'm super grateful to have the chance to do this and be able to participate in this. So thank you.
Thank you. You put so much thought into our conversation, and it's a pleasure to hang out with you and an honor to join you in this conversation with your audience. Thanks so much.
Awesome. Thank you.